Our final case for this morning is United States against White Feather. Mr. Shatnick.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. This is a case that stems from a murder trial that took place in the Southern District. My client and the decedent were cellmates at USP Marion. The events at issue took place in a locked cell on the evening of December 2nd, 2009. Basically, the government
was
had
there
filed...
Do you know of any particular reason they just happened to put two people from the Sioux Nation in the same cell?
The de facto policy of the Bureau of Prisons tends to be only to house Native Americans with Native Americans.
With other Native Americans, you say?
That's correct, sir. They don't. The policy is not necessarily to have them with the same tribe. Typically my client has indicated that he has only had a non-Native American cellmate on one day, and he has been incarcerated since 1978.
Is he in solitary now?
He has recently been transferred to Florence ADX, where he will be in solitary confinement, probably for the duration of his life.
So if you are willing to accept what we said in the Tokash case, namely that a person seeking to invoke a justification defense before he can get the jury instruction has got to show both imminence of the threat and no reasonable legal alternatives to avoid it, how can we rule in your favor?
Well, first off, Tokash wasn't a jury instruction case. It was an instruction
right,
of evidence case.
Right, but it does talk about
but
it.
But it stemmed from the same thing because Tokash was involved in an anticipatory possession of weapons for a anticipated racial war at USP Marion between the Aryan Brotherhood and I believe the DC Blacks. It was the same judge that Gilbert really addressed that also in Tokash and in the Sahakian case, which is they were members of the same organization, the Aryan Brotherhood.
So if Mr. Running Bear, after the second assault, is lying there unconscious on the floor to start with imminence, there's no dispute about that. That's what Mr. Whitefeather says in his testimony. So isn't the district judge entitled to say, well, even you say there's no imminence?
Well, that's what Judge Gilbert did say.
Why is he wrong?
From our perspective, we viewed it as a narrow window of imminence from the point of Mr. Whitefeather because there had already been preliminary skirmishes between himself and Mr. Running Bear to the point that Mr. Whitefeather, who was 20-some years older, 5 inches shorter, 30 pounds lighter, had been physically exhausted, was vomiting.
He thought he was going to wake up and take him on again.
That's right. He indicated he has
time to like wash his hands, right? And he throws up, and you know he does a few other things.
Well, before he begins to do the fatal blow, and it was at the point.
So that's like time enough to press the button, time to say. Help, you know.
But the imminence didn't start until he believed that Running Bear was getting up, which is when the tissue fell off the
tissue.
At that point,
away.
That's when the imminence kicks in. That's the point where you
but
had to make a decision.
But they've already been fighting for how long? They've been fighting for a while because there's the first part of the assault.
Right. There had been two prior events between them, and in those two prior events, I believe my client had indicated that he was not attempting to administer fatal blows to Mr. Running Bear. He was able to defend himself from Mr. Running Bear being the aggressor, but it was only at this last point after those two times when Running Bear had the tissue on his face and at the point that it came off, that's when my client reasonably believed that the onset was going to occur again because he had been surprised the first time that he had basically rendered Running Bear unconscious and had turned around and all of a sudden he turned around and Running was back up. So he knew from the experience of that day that Running Bear had the capability to rapidly recover consciousness, to rapidly resume the fight, to come at him, and that he knew that when he did wake up from that he was madder, that he was more violent. So that created a split-second timing when the tissue fell off Running Bear's face where my client felt that this was the imminence, this is starting,
what
and this is when I have to
deliver
the man. Pardon?
What was split-second about it? The guy is still unconscious and half under the bed. He had to be dragged out in order to begin the cutting.
I believe he testified that it was his perception that meant that he was alive and that meant the tissue coming off, that he was going to come back at him. That although it's not a legal offense, I think my client looks through the world of he's a paranoid schizophrenic, and it's not a defense in this case, and it doesn't justify his actions, but I think it just gives a framework for his view of the world and the realities that he's faced with. So,
well, in this case, I mean, it would, if I were the trial judge, I probably would have given the instruction. That's not what we're faced here. It's whether or not, I mean, I can understand that thinking, but was it really error for the district judge not to think that it was, you know, the button was there, the other stuff was there?
It's our position that it was error because the only defense we had was a potential self-defense.
Right.
And once that was knocked out of the box the day before we had closing argument, basically I had a self-defense case where I couldn't argue self-defense. The judge felt that we had not put on sufficient evidence that a rational or reasonable jury would be able to find for us. We differ in that assessment. We believe that there was sufficient evidence for the circumstances of this case and what my client's belief was sufficient to create a jury question as to whether or not his actions were reasonable in this case.
So what about the no reasonable legal alternatives? I mean, Whitefeather seems to say people just take care of themselves in prison, but we've held that we simply can't have a system where the law of the jungle applies in prisons. He doesn't really deny that he knows that button's on the wall. He thinks maybe it's for medical or whatever, but if you're in a situation where you need help, you summon it no matter what the button says. I mean, I don't see how he can prevail on that either, not to mention that he could have called out without any button or anything.
Well, it's our contention that at the point in time that this basically third altercation was in my client's mind about to start, that he had been physically depleted, so that would be something that a jury could consider as to whether or not at that time he would have or could have or should have called out.
Or pressed the button.
Well, and with regard to the button, though, the button, I think, is a red herring in this case because, first off, there's no information in the USP Marion inmate orientation even referencing the button as opposed to some other facilities that do have that, as we discussed in the final pretrial conference on April 11th. So there's no information that's given to them. There's no signage over the button that says, push this and something will happen. My client had indicated that he had heard or had believed that it was a medical button, and so if you push it, a doctor would come. But saying a doctor might come and saying that somebody's going to come save you from an assault are two different things. Additionally, there's no evidence in the record as to what the BOP policy or procedure would be in terms of coming onto that. The government had, I believe, carefully crafted a case where they did not ever raise that issue in terms of having people testify. What happens when we push the button and there's a fight? Do we come? Do we enter? Because the rebuttal on that from what we discussed at the April 11th hearing is that all they do is come and watch. They don't say today. And if the evidence in the case had been that if you push the button that they come and they save the day, then absolutely that would have been something that he should have done.
Hard to believe they would have stood by in this instance. But anyway, if you want to save a minute or two for rebuttal, I will let you do that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sure. Mr. Norwood.
I'm the lucky
Mr.
one.
Mr. Norwood, do you seriously think that a jury was likely to... I mean, what would have been the harm in letting the jury, after all this evidence comes in, think about self-defense?
Oh, I think the jury would have rendered the exact same verdict.
Yeah,
I think the issue is whether Judge Gilbert made an error, and he didn't make an error. With respect to imminence, obviously, your honors know the record. He was laying unconscious for 6 to 7 minutes, doing absolutely nothing.
Do we have a time of death in this case? Is that anywhere in the record?
There is not an exact time of death. I believe Mr. Whitefeather indicated it was about 1 a.m., but the prison does a check at 12 a.m., then 3 a.m., and then 5 a.m., and what Mr. Whitefeather did was lift up the dead body and put it back in the lower bunk and cover him with a blanket up to his neck so that when the guard shined a light in the window, they saw the back of Mr. Whitefeather's or the top of Mr. Whitefeather or Running Bear's head and said, okay, he's in his bunk. So it wasn't discovered until the body wasn't discovered until like 8:30 in the morning,
mm-hmm.
which is more than 2 hours, 2.5 hours after the cell doors open, and Mr. Whitefeather went about his business doing laundry, even though there's this dead, disemboweled body laying in his cell. But with respect to imminence, I think what's one thing that's crucial is on page 26 of the government's brief, the defendant testified he fell asleep for a period of time, almost. He said he fell asleep at some point while Mr. Running Bear is laying there doing nothing. Clearly, Mr. Whitefeather wasn't worried or frightened about anything at that point, but the fact that Mr. Running Bear lay there for 6 to 7 minutes, and then Mr. Whitefeather cut on him for another 4 minutes, and his body didn't move once, even when he reached inside and pulled out his organs, doesn't move, there was no imminence at all. There was, let's see, Your Honor's asked about, Mr. Whitefeather also formed the intent to kill and said he was going to kill Mr. Running Bear after the first incident. That's on page 19 of the brief of the government. During the first incident, Mr. White, and again, Mr. Running Bear isn't here to tell the story. Mr. Whitefeather claims that...
You were the trial attorney?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Mr. Whitefeather claimed that Running Bear swung the razor and cut him on his finger. I asked Mr. Whitefeather at that moment, this is during the very first altercation, at that moment you were going to kill him, right? Yes. No matter what happened at that moment, you decided I'm going to kill this man. Yes. So this is after the first incident, let alone after the body is laying there 6 to 7 minutes doing nothing in the cell.
Partially under, as Judge Sykes was saying, partially under the bunk?
According to Mr. Whitefeather's testimony, the legs were under the bunk, the torso was out from under the bunk. Mr. Whitefeather pulled the body out, and it still didn't move, and he sliced him open at that point. So Mr. Whitefeather actually had to move the body in order to kill him, and the body didn't respond with any type of movement or altercation at that point.
After the paper wafts away from the face?
Yes, and even in his testimony, Mr. Whitefeather later said, well, I think I may have made the paper move by moving a towel, but... with respect to the button, there is evidence in the record. I believe it was the second witness for the government. I believe it was Correctional Officer Brockett, maybe, testified what happens if a person does push the button. There is an alarm, a loud alarm that goes off at the control box. The only way to turn off that loud alarm is to go up to the actual cell and take a key and turn off the alarm at the cell.
But do we know, though, that Mr. Whitefeather knew this? I mean, maybe people know it, but...
As far as the mechanics of the loud alarm ringing...
Yeah, I mean, if he had pressed the button,
I don't know what's inside his head. All I know is he knows he's been in prison since 1978. There are only two buttons in this cell, a light switch and a button he said he knew would summon help.
You know, that's the first time I've heard in all these years that I've been federal judge of a button being in a cell that you could summon help. Is that fairly common these days in federal prison?
This was my first prison case. I know it was. It is at Marion Prison. I think it's at some other prisons.
Well, Marion, I could see. But, I mean, that's special.
But he knew it was there to summon help. And I thought one of the most curious answers Mr. Whitefeather gave is, I asked, you could have summoned a doctor for Mr. Running Bear after he disavowed him. And Mr. Whitefeather said, well, yeah, for me too, because he had a little cut on his finger. And I said,
doctor would have showed up at 1
o'clock.
For you
too. Well, maybe I believe they have a medical facility right there. And
I mean, I don't doubt that someone would showed up.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Does the record disclose how the razor blades, how they had razor blades in the cell?
They can get them from the commissary. USP Marion is now a medium security facility, not the most maximum facility.
Oh, so they're permitted to have them.
They are permitted to have razor blades.
These are these little big disposable things took apart?
Yes, Your Honor. Whitefeather had a little white big disposable. Running Bear had a green disposable razor. The razor blade, they can just take the razor blade apart, and inside it is a little flimsy razor blade.
But it can do the damage.
Obviously, yes, Your Honor. But
there's no other evidence of weapons in the cell that they might have constructed for themselves.
And this isn't in the record, but it was a shock to me that, for example, Mr. Running Bear had a pencil sharpener, an old-fashioned pencil sharpener you hold in your hand. It's about that big. It had a straight razor blade in the inside that could have easily been removed. I mean, he didn't. It was still intact inside his cell. But I would have guessed before this case that you would not have allowed an inmate to have a pencil sharpener. But little did I know. But the big razor blades at issue in this case matched the razor blades that were in Whitefeather's property. Your Honor, I have no further questions.
No, apparently not. Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Shatnick?
Just a few things with regard to a few points. Mr. Norwood mentioned that my client was falling asleep. It's our position, and we indicated in the brief, that that was my client's perception, which is basically that he was fading in and out of consciousness rather than having a peaceful sleep. With regard to Mr. Brockett testifying as to the procedures with regard to what he would do if a button was pushed, that he would go up the range, go up, and he would have to turn it off at the doorway of the cell, that still doesn't give us any information of what his response would have been to seeing a fight, what would have been BOP's response as to whether or not they would have come and watched the fight as opposed to entering the cell, especially on the 1 o'clock in the morning shift with regard to that. With regard to whether or not these buttons are at other BOP facilities, my client had testified that he had been in a number of prisons from 1978 until he made it to Marion, and this is the first time that he had ever been in a cell with such a button. And in fact, even with Marion, if you look back for the time frame of the Tokash and the Sahakian case, there were no buttons of BOP Marion. This is part of the sexual offender unit where they have newly constructed ranges, and as part of the new construction, this particular area and a few others have the buttons, but other than that, they are kind of dicey as to whether or not they have them in facilities. Any other questions, or if not, thank you.
I don't think so, and you were appointed, were you not?
Yes, ma'am.
We appreciate very much your help to the court, to your client. Thank you as well, Mr. Norwood. The court will take the case under advisement, and we will be in recess until tomorrow.